3. Locked Doors. Chapter 14. Everything happens in shit weather. In November, there's nice days when the sky is clear and it might be cool, but a sweatshirt and jeans will suffice. Nothing happens on those days. It waits to hit until there's a freezing rain. Steve Auburn lifted the woolly collar of his patrol jacket to cover the back of his neck. His cowboy hat was like a shingle, pooling stinging cold water in its brim until he lowered his head to spill it out. The sloped mountainside was slippery enough to send a man tumbling down the steep incline. He could picture himself rolling ass over tin cups all the way down until he smacked into a tree thick enough to smash his brains out. He gripped the roots sticking up through the ground above him, taking it slow. He was 100 feet above where the bones of the little girl's foot had been found, searching for the place they'd slid down from. They were searching in sectors, each man taking a small piece of each area. Ahead of him, he could see Officer Paul waving his hands in the air. "I got something, Chief! Over here!" Paul cried. "Come on!" "I see you, for God's sake! Stop hollering!" Auburn shouted back, gripping a handful of tree roots and making his way toward the next. "You see me coming right toward you, don't you?"
"I know, but..."
Paul huffed, clutching his chest like he was afraid his heart might burst through it.
"I got something!"
Auburn came up alongside him and looked down at a small pile of what looked like black dirt covered by wet leaves. There was a scrape of mud going through the center of it, etched with a pattern of department-issued police boots. At the slash's center was a narrow bone, brown with age, the length of a child's forearm.
"I stepped on something and it rolled my ankle," Paul said.
Auburn pulled out his phone to take a quick photograph of the bone and the mudslide. He could see what looked like more bones sticking out of the debris pile. It was easy to tell what had happened. The body had lain there for decades until it grew brittle enough that the rain eventually washed pieces of it down the hillside. Whatever they couldn't find here, they'd find somewhere below, Auburn thought. He pulled out his police radio and pressed it close to his mouth.
"Chief Auburn to all search units. I think we found it."
He gave them his location and said,
"Everybody meet me up here. Somebody bring all the crime scene stuff from the back of my car, and don't forget the camera and tape. Somebody get a hold of that girl detective from the county. She's going to want to know about this."
By the time Carrie arrived, they'd recovered most of the skeleton, laying it out on a large blue tarp spread across the flattest part of the incline they could find. The majority of Hope Hugh's bones were intact. It looked like only the extremities had come apart. Only a few finger bones and pieces of the right leg were missing. The men were spread out across the hill, combing through the dirt with their gloved hands, looking for them. Steve Auburn came up beside her and looked down at the remains. He was holding a sealed coffee can in his hands, the large kind they sold in bulk stores. He set it down on the tarp by the skeleton's feet and stood, taking off his cowboy hat to wipe his forearm through his sweaty hair, so he didn't touch himself with his rubber glove.
"I guess that's that," he said. "Probably for the best. I never was a fan of mysteries."
Carrie slid on a pair of gloves and bent over the skull, peering at it from every angle. No cracks, no bullet holes, no chunks missing. She looked over the rest of the skeleton. No visible signs of damage to any of the bones.
"It's funny, I remember my parents talking about this case when it happened," Auburn said. "My mother said she probably ran off and was hitchhiking on the highway. She said the girl's father was probably doing things he shouldn't have been doing because that's the only reason a little girl would run off like that. My dad said it was more likely she was playing up in the mountains and she slipped and fell and broke her neck. Either that or a bear got her."
He smirked and said,
"Can you believe that? The old man was right."
Carrie looked up at him. "What do you mean?"
"She's exactly where he'd said she'd be. Poor kid, I hope it wasn't a bear."
"You see any teeth marks on any of these bones?" Carrie asked. "There's not a single scratch. She didn't fall and break her neck either. There's 1,000 scavengers in these woods, and they'd have torn a rotting body to pieces. She'd be scattered all over the place. She had to be buried right after she was killed. She decomposed in the ground and got washed out of her grave over time. It's the only explanation."
I'm sorry, I didn't realize you were some kind of expert in exhuming bodies, Miss Santero. Is that something they teach you at first-year county detective school?
Auburn hiked up his gun belt.
What? You thought I wasn't going to ask around about you? They might have sent you out here to keep you out of their hair for a little while, but don't you think for one second I'm going to let you turn this into some kind of freak show.
Look, I'm not trying to make this a freak show. I'm just trying to figure out what happened to her.
We figured out what happened to her. She came out here, got dead, and now 40 years later I'm stuck dealing with the cleanup. You're dismissed.
Carrie watched him walk away, planting his ridiculous cowboy hat on his head as he headed back up the incline. She heard hollering from up the hill. One of the searchers had found a finger bone. She waited for Auburn to get far enough up the hill that she lost sight of him in the trees, and bent down to the coffee can and popped the lid off. It was filled with the tattered remains of sopping wet cloth. Most of it had turned black, but as she spread it out and unfolded it, she could see small indications of colorful patterns. Underwear, with balloons on it, Carrie realized. She found another clump of cloth at the bottom of the can and dumped it onto the tarp. It was thick and fuzzy, and as she peeled it apart, she saw the faint traces of its light blue fabric, the matching sock to the one back in her hotel room. None of it was any good for recovering trace evidence, she thought. Too wet, too damaged, too exposed to the elements. In books, crime scene experts can compare grains of sand to imaginary databases that list distinguishable grains from all the beaches in the world and all sorts of other fantastical bullshit. That's not reality. She'd found entire strands of hair at crime scenes and been told they were useless because they didn't have the root attached. In the real world, putting a big case together is a pain in the ass, and the people you rely on for help don't want to do jack shit. Nobody cares. The labs don't care. The courts don't care. You were lucky if the victim cared, 6 to 8 months down the road when it finally went to court and they had to keep taking off work and coming back to testify. That was the reality of police work they don't tell you in the police academy, she thought. No wonder Auburn wanted to put this case to bed as quickly as possible. Missing person, found body, no cause determined, parents notified, case closed. Go home, she thought. They don't want you here. Tell that dickhead Harv Bender you helped out, didn't cause a fuss, and most certainly didn't hook up a bug zapper in a hotel room to base the entirety of your investigative suspicion on. Because nobody else cares, and neither should you. She looked at the skeleton of the little girl spread out on the tarp. The caverns in her skull where her eyes had been, the crooked teeth in her jawbone, not yet fitted for braces. The tiny bones of her ribs and the narrow bones of her hips. Some asshole had ground down on top of those same hips, doing the unthinkable. And then he killed her. Fuck that, Carrie said aloud. She looked to make sure no one was watching, then slid her cell phone out of her pocket and took a quick photograph of the clothing items altogether. She picked up the sock in her gloved hand, hiding it there, and took it all the way back to her car, needing a bag to put it in. Chapter 15. The only person working at the front desk of the Vieira County District Attorney's Office was Miss Mabel, the staff secretary. Mabel was seated behind the glass window at the entrance, doing a crossword puzzle. Past her, Carrie could see everyone else in the office had crowded at the rear of the main room, back where the county detectives worked. Some of them were standing on chairs to look over the heads of their colleagues.
"What's going on back there?" Carrie asked.
"They caught that police impersonator who went after that poor girl," Mabel said.
"You're kidding me."
"Chief Bender has him in the interrogation room now,"
Mabel replied, filling in one of the words.
"He getting a confession in there, or what?" Carrie asked.
"So far, all I heard was him screaming and yelling. There might have been some tears, but knowing Harv Bender, that was him, too."
Carrie stifled a laugh.
"Do you have access to the old records room?" "Why? Don't you have a key?"
"I can't get into any of the records rooms or supply closets," Carrie said.
Mabel opened her desk drawer and searched through a pile of keys.
They trust you detectives with guns, but they're afraid you're going to run off with all the paper towels and toilet paper.
That's because they know how little they pay us, Carrie said. Mabel handed her the keys.
Now you be careful in there. Everything's a mess, and there's boxes stacked all the way to the ceiling that look ready to come down any second. Last time somebody was in there, they saw a rat and screamed so loud everybody came running.
Carrie took the ring of keys and tapped the gun against her hip.
I'm ready for any rats. Trust me. Just try not to accidentally shoot anybody through the walls, Mabel said,
then leaned forward to whisper.
Not unless it's somebody I don't like.
I'll do my best, Miss Mabel, Carrie said, walking down the hall. If you hear me scream, make sure you duck. She worked the key into the door to the records room and pushed it open, groaning at the sight of towering columns of cardboard boxes stuffed full of loose papers. The lower boxes had buckled, crushed beneath each tower's weight, but all of the stacks leaned together at the top, somehow supporting each other enough to stay upright. Rusted filing cabinets lined the walls, with a few scattered throughout the middle of the room. Boxes were stacked on top of them, too. Carrie stared at this strange, interconnected labyrinth of columns and boxes and cabinets. The danger wasn't rodents. The danger was bumping into a load-bearing tower and having it collapse on top of you.
Goddamn, I hate Jenga, she muttered, sidestepping her way inside the room.
She clipped one of the oddly angled boxes with her shoulder and cringed when it swayed, but it didn't fall. Many of the boxes were covered in ancient water stains and split open along the seams. They were held together with duct tape, bursting with papers that had been stuffed inside. Everywhere she stepped was littered with containers that had fallen apart and vomited their contents across the floor. Case numbers were printed on yellowed labels that peeled away from their box's surface, or had been scrawled across the front of the folder in magic marker. Each tower seemed to be stacked by year, and as she reached the back of the room, they grew shorter. She reached the last tower and realized they only covered until the mid-90s. All the years beyond that were stored in the filing cabinets. She found the cabinet for 1981 cases. Everything was organized by blue index cards, going by type of incident and the date. She searched for the February cases and had to bend down to the lowest drawer. She pulled it, but it was stuck. Oh, shit, she whispered, looking up at the towering stack of case files piled on top of it. Carrie covered her head with her hand and yanked. The files above her swayed back and forth, but held. She gently pulled the drawer the rest of the way out. Toward the back, she found a file marked Hope Pugh, Missing Juvenile. She pulled it free, disappointed at how thin a case file it was. Most of it had nothing to do with Hope at all. Someone had collected articles related to Oliver Raine's suicide and Walt Auburn's heroic last stand, as well as correspondence from that time. Someone, Carrie thought. It had to be Jacob Raine. She sat down on the floor and leaned back against one of the filing cabinets. She spread the file across her lap and picked up the first page. It was a letter from Chief Walt Auburn, written to the county detectives on February 16, 1981, the same day Auburn died. Dear District Attorney and Chief of County Detectives, it is my sad duty to report that Chief Oliver Raine has died as a result of suicide, and I am temporarily assuming command of the Patterson Borough Police Department's jurisdiction. Beneath the letter was a newspaper article showing the picture of Walt Auburn. The headline above his photo read, "The Hero of Liston." Liston Police Chief Walter C. Auburn was killed last night as a result of his duties. Auburn was investigating a local motorcycle gang and had tracked the bandits to their hideout. In confronting the suspects, Auburn engaged them in a gunfight and killed all five by himself. In doing so, he received fatal wounds and succumbed to them at the scene. The newspaper article showed two photographs of each motorcycle member. A military photo taken when they were younger and fresh out of boot camp, and mugshots taken years later for various crimes. Each one of them had aged hard, Carrie thought. Whether that was from the war or drugs or just bad living, she couldn't tell. But if she'd seen any of them in a dark alley, She'd have put her hand on her gun and been ready to pull it. Next was a yellow piece of legal paper covered in handwritten notes. This is Jacob's handwriting, she realized, reading the page more carefully. At the top of the page was the name Hope Pugh, with her date of birth and social security number written beside it. On the left side of the page was a series of boxes written as questions, and on the right were the answers. And they all said the same thing. Driver's license photo? No record found. Credit history? No record found. Voter registration? No record found. Arrest record? No record found. Passport history? No passport issued. Next to every remaining category in the list was a blank response. There had been no name changes, no activity on her social security number, no bank accounts had ever been opened by her. If Hope Pugh had survived into adulthood, there would be some record of her, somewhere. Jacob Rain was looking for her, all those years later, still clinging to the idea that Hope might still be out there. She wasn't. Carrie could see Rain's handwriting weaken as the list went on, as if the strength to answer his own questions was being wrung out of him with each hard truth. She pictured him sitting at his desk all those years ago, alone, searching for a person who could not be found. As alone as she felt in that moment, sitting on the dirty floor in the records room, and no closer to the truth. Carrie turned down the corridor and headed toward the crowd of attorneys. They'd surrounded the interrogation room. Some had backed away from what they saw through the one-way glass, their faces pale and stiff. The ones who stayed looked on hungrily. The wall shook with a loud crash, and the hulking form of Harv Bender pressed against the window, his forearm wedged under another man's chin and chest. Harv was close enough to him to fling spit at the other man's face when he said, "You like to rape defenseless women? Yes, scumbag? You like to dress up like a cop? Since you like rape so much, tell you what, I'm gonna put you in a place where rape happens all the time. I don't think you'll like the way they do it, though. A nice little white boy like you, you're gonna be real, real popular in there." Blood trickled down the suspect's nose, leaking onto Bender's white dress shirt, but he didn't mind. He was winding it up for his audience, shouting loud enough to make sure everyone heard. Slamming the suspect into the wall must have gotten a big reaction for him to do it so soon again. The guy was a foot shorter than Bender, and gagging on the forearm wedged under his throat, squirming to get enough room to breathe.
"I didn't rape anybody," he gasped. "I told you, I was just trying to go around that lady because she was driving too slow."
Bender tossed him aside, scowling in disgust. He lifted his beefy arms to inspect them, seeing the bloodstains there, turning them to make sure everyone standing behind the winter could see too.
"I'm gonna give you some time to think things over. When I come back, it's either going to get a lot better for you or a lot worse. Worse than anything you can imagine. I've got guys with toilet plungers standing outside, and they are dying to come in here. You better tell me something I want to hear when I get back, or else."
Carrie watched the man rub his throat and sit on the floor, lowering his head into his hands. Bender came through the door, beaming at the crowd gathered there who'd been watching him perform. He held his finger to his lips, telling everyone to keep quiet as he pulled the door shut behind him with a soft click.
"These walls are thin," he whispered.
He pointed through the window.
"See how he's sitting there with his head down? That's a classic give-up pose. He knows he's beat, so he's conserving his energy. When I go back in there, he'll crack like an egg."
Carrie could see the man's shoulders and back twitching as he sobbed into his arms. She'd heard of suspects laying their heads on the interrogation table as a sign of them giving up, but never tucking themselves into a ball in the corner of the room and crying like a baby. Give-up signs and the like were all part of the body language bullshit shysters got paid teaching seminars to gullible people like Harv Bender. That was one of the first things she'd learned from Jacob Rain. Bender saw her staring through the window and tapped her arm, smiling wide.
See that? The old dog still has some tricks up his sleeve after all. How long did it take me to solve your fake cop rapist case? A few days?
Yeah, nice job, Carrie said. How'd you get him?
He waved for her to follow him down the hall toward his office. Along the way, Bender stepped into the kitchenette to scrub his arms in the sink. He rinsed off the soap and checked his arms for blood.
Rod Turley. That's our guy, Bender said over his shoulder. Mr. Turley tried pulling a woman over on a deserted road out past the water treatment plant this morning. Real isolated area. Unfortunately for him, she'd read something in the paper about your case. What's your victim's name? Monica Gear?
That's right, Carrie said.
Bender dried off his arms with a handful of paper towels, then tossed them away.
So this chick calls 911. Turley sees her on the phone and tries taking off, but the locals stopped him. My victim ID'd him at the scene. Now he's all mine.
Carrie followed Bender into his office.
Was he dressed like a cop?
Several large paper bags lay open on Bender's desk.
No uniform, no badge, none that we found yet, anyway. No flashlight either, Bender said, reaching into the largest bag. But he did have this.
The chief pulled out a rectangular light box with four blue bulbs and a long cord with a cigarette lighter plug-in attachment. Underneath the box was a bracket where it had been mounted on a car's dashboard, and chunks of the dashboard were still stuck to it from where the cops had ripped it out. Bender held it up triumphantly, displaying his prize.
A volunteer firefighter's blue light? Carrie said.
That's right, Bender said. This is what he stopped my girl with, and we got it before he had time to ditch it. I've already got a phone call into that Monica Gear gal, but from what I heard about her being a psycho, I don't expect to hear back.
She told me it was definitely blue and red lights that pulled her over, Carrie said. Kind of a difference, right?
Happens all the time, Bender said, dropping the blue light back into the evidence bag. He probably read that article in the paper and knew it was time to change his M.O. You of all people should know these mutts don't always fit the usual profile.
Right, Carrie whispered. Well, nice job, boss, she added.
Now do you see why I was telling you to slow down? You never want to run with your choke out in these kinds of situations.
He tapped his finger against the side of his head.
You always gotta use this, okay?
Okay, Chief, she said. I'll remember that.
Good. So talk to me. How'd it go out and enlist in Patterson?
They found the rest of the body, which is good, I guess, Carrie said. But that chief out there, he's different.
How do you mean? Bender asked. You know he called here, checking up on you. I only talked to him for a few minutes. He seemed to feel like you were done with your assistance.
I gotta be honest, I'm glad to be out of there. The guy kept saying shit about us. How we don't know our asses from holes in the ground. How you are just some political hack who blew enough people to finally get the chief's job. I had to tell him to shut his damn mouth a few times. I'm telling you, boss, if this guy worked for you, you wouldn't put him in charge of a school crossing.
Bender's brow twitched as she spoke. Carrie gave it a second, letting it all sink in before she went on.
I'm not surprised he wants the county out of his little kingdom. I don't think they know what the hell they're doing. He's terrified I'm going to see something and come back and report it to you and you'll come down on them like holy hellfire.
Carrie leaned against the doorframe, staying casual, not looking at Bender's sweaty, inflamed face.
Anyway, that's what I think.
Bender ran his hand through his hair.
Tell you what, give it a few more days down there. Lay low, stay quiet. I want you to report back to me on every single thing that little cocksucker does and says. Maybe I'll go have a little chat with him when this is all wrapped up and explain just who is who in this county.
You sure? Carrie asked. I'd rather be up here helping you with this rapist case.
I've got this under control,
Bender said, hiking his pants and belt up over the lower lid of his belly.
You just get back there and make sure those bozos don't miss anything important.
Understood, Carrie said.
Now excuse me,
Bender said, moving past her to go back down the hall toward the interrogation room.
I have to go have another conversation with my new friend and see if he wants to play nice or receive the worst ass-beating of his miserable life.
Hey, boss, Carrie called out after him. I forgot to ask, is this guy Turley a volunteer firefighter?
He says he was a few years ago, but I haven't checked it out yet. Those guys are supposed to hand those blue lights back in once they stop being active members. Him still having it is what we call, in the detective world, Exhibit A.
Bender went back through the door into the interrogation room. The people still gathered around the window pressed forward again. Carrie hurried by, wanting to be as far away as possible from whatever was about to happen inside that room. As she passed, Turley looked up from his table, as if he could see her through the mirror, his wet eyes pleading with her to stay. Maybe he was the right guy, Carrie thought. Maybe he really did swap out his entire scheme as a cop, which was completely effective, just to try out something lame and nonsensical instead. A volunteer firefighter with a plug-in blue light. Of course that wouldn't work, Carrie thought. The most people did was slow down to let blue lighters go around them. Nobody ever pulled over and stopped. And if they did, they damn sure didn't provide their driver's license information to a volunteer firefighter or comply with their orders. Jesus Christ, they barely complied with cops. Rod Turley would have to be the biggest idiot in history for running that ruse, especially if he'd already found a good one that worked. And if there's one thing about bad guys that she knew, when they found something that worked, they didn't abandon it. They improved. She looked back at the shriveled man through the window, even as Bender leaned toward him and seethed.
You gonna tell me what I wanna know, or am I gonna have to get unpleasant?
Maybe Monica Gere was wrong, Carrie thought. Maybe she was lying. Maybe she was trying to make it sound bigger than it actually was, or justify why she hadn't fought back, or a million other possibilities that could somehow explain how Rod Turley was the right guy for the rape. But not likely. The over-eagerness to fit a suspect to the crime, instead of letting it evolve organically, is any criminal investigator's Achilles heel. She knew that only amateurs and idiots took any oddly shaped puzzle piece and rammed it into the one opening they most desperately needed to fill. Forcing it to fit didn't make it true. Even if a jury came back with a guilty verdict, that didn't make it true either. When it was true, you could see it, prove it, examine it 1,000 different ways, and it still remained, never had to be bent. The truth rings clear, like a bell, and even if it's crazy, it always makes sense. Carrie tucked the Oliver Rain case folder tight under her arm, heading for the exit. Inside the interrogation room, Rod Turley was crying out for someone to help him. But Carrie let the door slam close behind her and kept going. Chapter 16. On the morning of his preliminary hearing, Rod Turley shuffled into the district court lobby wearing the same orange jumpsuit he'd worn since being placed in county prison. He was shackled across his hands and feet and shuffled past his mother and father, too ashamed to look at them.
"Come on this way," Dave Kenderdine said.
He escorted Turley into the courtroom and sat him down at the nearest table next to the public defender. She was an unhappy-looking woman with long black hair and a purple blazer. Turley leaned in to ask her a question, and she told him not to speak. Judge Jean Smythe entered the courtroom in a black flowing robe. Everyone but Turley stood. The judge was in her late 60s, but fresh-faced and smiling. She looked like someone's grandmother. She even smiled at him and said good morning. Turley wiggled out of his chair and stood as well, as hard as it was with his limbs chained together.
"Please be seated," Judge Smythe said.
"Your Honor,"
Turley called out.
"Sit down,"
the public defender said, pulling on his arm.
"Your Honor, I didn't do anything. I'm innocent,"
he said, talking over the sound of the judge slapping her gavel on the bench.
All of the judge's grandmotherly goodness evaporated as she leveled a crooked finger at the public defender.
Advise your client not to say another word. That's the first and last warning he gets.
Keep your mouth shut and let me do the talking, the public defender said through clenched teeth. Turley looked around the courtroom. His mother and father were seated behind him. His father's arm was clenched tight around his mother, and she was weeping. Only a swinging wooden gate separated where they sat from where he was, but it seemed 1,000 miles away. At the table to his left was the prosecution side. The assistant district attorney looked like he wasn't old enough to shave. He wore thin, stylish glasses, and his hair was slicked back with so much product it reflected the lights from the ceiling above. Seated next to him was the fat cop who'd beaten Turley up and thrown him in prison. Harve Bender, Chief of County Detectives, Turley had heard him say over and over. Bender had called him a rapist and a scumbag. On the way to the jail, when they were alone, Bender had said he'd see to it that the guards beat Turley on a daily basis. Now, Bender looked sweaty and agitated. Both his legs were bouncing up and down in his seat like he was running as fast as he could but not going anywhere.
Your Honor, the assistant district attorney said, raising his hand to silence Bender. Before we begin, the Commonwealth would like to request a continuance.
On what grounds? Judge Smythe said.
Our victim cannot be here today, the ADA replied.
The public defender shot to her feet.
Objection, Your Honor. Nothing in the paperwork indicates there has even been a positive ID on my client. I'd respectfully like to know if the victim is even cooperating at this point.
We're not prosecuting the case right now. You'll see our evidence when we are ready to proceed, the ADA said.
Your Honor, I move for immediate dismissal, the public defender said. My client has been held in prison for days based on nothing but Chief Bender's criminal complaint, which, with all due respect, is nearly incoherent.
Judge Smythe looked at the ADA, who looked about to protest but had nothing to offer. Behind him, Harve Bender made a small choking sound. The judge slid the criminal complaint across her desk and read through all of Turley's information in the list of charges. She licked her thumb and turned to the page to the affidavit of probable cause, a long narrative that detailed all of the events in the case, written and signed by Bender. Judge Smythe's eyes narrowed before she finished the first paragraph. She looked up from her desk.
Did the DA's office review this before it was filed?
No, Your Honor,
the ADA said, moving slightly away from where Harve Bender sat.
I can't accept this, the judge said. She smacked her gavel and said, dismissed. If and when the Commonwealth is ready to proceed, this court is ready to hear their case.
She snapped her fingers and said,
Sergeant Kenderdine, release this man from custody immediately.
Turley was too confused to realize what was happening when the sergeant took him by the arms and raised him out of the seat.
Just hold steady, Kenderdine said. Raise your hand so we can get the key in.
Yes, sir,
Turley said, too numb to move.
What just happened?
He felt his mother and father come up behind him. His mother wrapped her arms around his back, embracing him. Kenderdine unlocked the cuffs. He saw Bender rise up from his chair, face purple with rage, and patted Turley on the shoulder.
You can go now. There was a problem with the paperwork. Listen, stay out of trouble and lay low for a while, all right?
It wasn't me. I told them that from the beginning. I hope you get whoever it is. I really do, Turley said.
I'm sure we will, Kenderdine said, watching Bender slam the swinging gate open to pass through it.
The man's hands were curled into tight fists. Harve Bender shoved the courthouse door open so hard it smacked the wall behind the entryway.
Son of a bitch, he shouted.
He bent forward and pounded his fists against his thighs.
Son of a freaking bitch!
Bad day at the office, Harve, a voice called out to him.
A shabbily dressed man sat on a park bench nearby. His thick beard and threadbare clothing made him look like a homeless person killing time.
No, not a homeless person, Bender realized. Something much worse.
What are you doing here?
Bender said. He stood up and straightened his tie.
Get arrested again?
No, not lately, Jacob Raines said. I came to talk to you about your case.
My case? Bender snorted. Why would I possibly want to talk to you about my case?
Because you arrested the wrong man. I knew that before I came here. And now everyone in that courtroom knows it too. That word's going to spread, Harv.
You, Bender seethed. You pompous, arrogant, convicted felon piece of shit. Who the hell are you to tell me anything about police work?
That's right. I forgot, Raines said, turning to look at the road along the courthouse as the cars raced by. You're the master detective who caught the Omni-killer. Isn't that what the press release said? I read all about it in the papers. There's still reporters trying to talk to me, you know. I was hoping I could just let the story you gave them suffice. He glanced back at Bender. I mean, really? What could I add? Bender looked back at the courthouse doors, making sure no one was coming who could overhear them. He moved closer to Rain and said,
What do you want?
Rain stood up and walked toward Bender's unmarked police car, a brand new SUV, all black, with tinted windows so dark they were like mirrors. I told you. I want to talk about your case. Get in the car. I need you to drive me somewhere.
Jesus H. Christ, am I a taxi service now? Bender asked.
He pulled out his keys that unlocked the doors, then tossed the useless evidence bag in the back seat. He slid into the driver's seat and started the car.
You're lucky I don't want to be seen in public talking to you, or else you'd be taking the Shoe Leather Express. What do you want to tell me?
Rain reached in his pocket for a small scrap of paper bearing an address on Fawn Drive, only a few miles from where they were. He passed it to Bender and said, Over the past year, there's been 6 reports of suspicious vehicles following women or road rage incidents where a male was swerving in the lane all around them, possibly trying to get them to pull over. It's always at night, always on some back road.
And how do you know that? Harv asked.
I filed Freedom of Information Act requests at every police department in this part of the county, Rain said. You'd be amazed what they hand over if you fill out the right forms.
Turley's the guy, Bender said. He had the emergency light in his car, for Christ's sake. He was in the right area at the right time trying to pull someone over.
Monica Gear didn't say he had that kind of light, Rain said. She said he had red and blue lights, like a police car. Bender sneered.
Oh, you'd just love that, wouldn't you? You'd just about cream your jeans if this turns out to be a cop. Why, so someone could finally replace you as the most recent cop arrested in this county?
I never said it was a cop, Rain said.
Think about it.
6 reports of women being followed, but none of them lead to an encounter. None of them are successful. Criminals evolve. They learn. So what does he do? He gets himself a light bar and a uniform. That works just fine. And now that he's got a method that works, it's only going to get worse. Bender glanced at Rain as he talked. Still the same old smug asshole he'd been back in their county detective days. Except now Rain had a beard that grew down to his chest and clothes so worn out they looked like rags.
What's your deal now? Bender asked. You some kind of homeless investigator? You riding the rails solving mysteries for the other hobos?
Can't I just want to help? Rain said.
Please, Bender said. I know you, man. I know the real you. You don't do this shit because you want to help. You did it for the attention and to prove everyone else wrong. And maybe now you do it out of guilt for what you did to that little girl you hit when you were drunk driving. But none of it, not any of it, is because you want to help.
Maybe, Rain said. Or maybe I just can't stand to sit back and watch someone like you do it so badly.
Harv Bender checked the address on the slip of paper and the numbers on the mailbox as they drove along Fawn Drive.
"This is the one right here."
He pulled up to the curb in front of the house and said,
"Well, Rain, have a nice day.
Feel free to drop dead and never bother me again, if that's all right with you." Rain looked out the window at the house. A red Honda was parked in the driveway.
"You're coming with me," he said. "Bring a notebook and a pen."
Bender leaned forward to look at the house.
"What are you talking about? Who lives here?"
"Monica Gear, your victim," Rain said, letting himself out before Bender could stop him.
"Are you crazy?"
Bender hissed, keeping his voice down. He hurried out of the car to get hold of Rain and drag him back.
"This chick is nuts. She'll freak out if we show up like this. I called her 5 times. When she finally called me back, she told me she'd sue me if I didn't stop harassing her."
"Too late now," Rain said, raising his head toward the front windows of the house. A shadow passed behind the curtains, peeling one of their edges back just enough to peer through. Rain headed up the driveway, waving.
"This is bullshit, Rain, even for you,"
Bender called out, not moving from the sidewalk.
"I'm not getting sued for you. Forget it."
Rain pulled open the screen door and knocked. The curtain stopped moving, but the door stayed closed.
"Monica," Rain said, leaning in.
He could see someone standing behind the door's frosted glass windows.
"I'm Jacob Rain, and I'm here with Chief Bender from the county detectives. Listen, I know you don't want to talk to the police, and I understand that. We're not here to force you to do anything. I just want you to give me a minute of your time. Hear me out, and then I'll go away if you want."
Monica Gear's voice, fragile and faint, came through the door.
"I read that they arrested the man who did this."
"It was the wrong guy," Rain said. "The cops screwed up. They did it with good intentions, but to be honest, without your help, they went down the wrong path. The real bad guy's still out there. I was hoping you could help us with that."
"Are you a police officer?" she asked.
"Why, don't I look like one?" Rain asked. When she didn't answer, he smiled and said, "I'm kidding. No, ma'am, I'm not a police officer. I just know a lot about the kind of person who hurt you, and I wanted to tell you something about him." He could hear the floorboards creak behind the door, but it didn't open, and she didn't speak. "You see, right now, he's congratulating himself on picking someone he thinks is too weak to come forward," Rain said. "He's thinking he has all the power. He figures he made you afraid and you'll stay that way for the rest of your life. What he doesn't know is that you hold his entire future in your hands. You are the one who decides what happens to him. You want him to get away and do it to someone else? That's fine. Do nothing, and that's what will happen. But there's another path. A path where you help us find him, and we drag him in front of you in chains. Where you watch him weep and beg for mercy and collapse when the judge sentences him to prison for the rest of his life. It's up to you. Choose to live in fear or fight back and teach him what it means to be afraid." He waited, looking at the door. Behind him, Harv Bender was leaning against his SUV, shaking his head.
"Step away from the front door," he heard Monica say.
Rain stepped back and let the screen door close. The deadbolt on the door clicked as it turned. The handle beneath it jiggled and the door came open to reveal a disheveled, stricken-looking Monica Gear. She looked past him at Harv Bender, seeing his badge, and then at Rain, taking in his disheveled appearance. She locked the screen door and stood behind it.
"I'll talk to you like this, but you can't come in."
"That's fine," Rain said. He waved for Bender to come up, enjoying the way the man's chubby face tightened and turned red.
"Miss Gear would like to speak with you," Rain said. "Kiss my ass," Bender said under his breath as he made his way toward the front door.
That's close enough,
Monica said, halting Bender before he could come any closer.
Are you the man I talked to on the phone?
I'm Chief Bender of the County Detectives, Bender said.
He saw Rain roll his eyes. Bender tried again and said,
I'm Harv, ma'am. I'd like to help you with your case, if you don't mind.
What is it you want to know?
First, what makes you so positive this was a police officer? Bender asked.
Rain held up his hand. Hold that thought, Miss Gear. We don't know anything about the suspect. Let's start with the basics, okay?
All right,
she said. Was he white, black, or something else?
White,
she said. How do you know that? Rain asked.
I saw his arm when he reached into the car to grab me.
Was he a tall guy or short?
Average, she said.
What's average? My height?
I'm not sure,
she said. Her voice quickened and she seemed short of breath.
He was standing over me while I was in the car, and then he... Oh, God.
It's okay, Rain said gently. Do you want to take a break?
I need to sit down,
Monica said.
That's fine, Rain said. Take as long as you like. Me and Harv aren't doing anything except working on this case. We'll wait out here all day if you want. Right, Harv?
Rain, Bender muttered. Monica threw the lock open on the screen door and said,
This is stupid. Just come in.
Yes, ma'am. Rain said as Monica retreated into the living room. He held up his bare wrist and looked at Bender. What was that? 5 minutes? Bender's eyes narrowed and Rain added, Maybe it was 10. I can't be sure. I might be slipping. Let's say it was 10.
Excuse the mess, Monica said as they entered.
She was curled up on a chair next to a dark fireplace with her legs tucked beneath her. The living room table was littered with takeout food containers, all of them nearly still full.
I haven't left the house since I came home from the hospital, she said. You're the first people I've spoken to.
Rain and Bender both sat down on the couch across from her. Is there anyone we can call for you? A friend or family member? Rain asked.
I haven't told anyone, she whispered. I just want it to go away.
It doesn't go away, Rain said. Not on its own.
There's an agency in the county for victim assistance, Bender said. Their number will be in the packet of information you got at the hospital. If you give them a call, they can help. They're real good.
I'll think about it, Monica said. So what else do you want to know about him?
Anything. Rain said. Any little detail you can remember, a tattoo, a chipped tooth, particular phrases he used when he spoke, whatever you can think of.
He was mean, she said. He was strong.
She gritted her teeth until her jaw quivered.
He was just so angry.
Bender wrote as she spoke, holding his pen on the page, waiting for her to continue. She didn't. He looked up at Rain, who frowned.
Okay, that's good.
Is there anything about the way he looked that you can tell us?
It all happened so fast, she whispered.
She covered her eyes with her hand.
All I can see is the bright lights flashing and him holding me down. Why did he do that? I was just trying to go home.
Bender shook his head. This was a dead end. Rain hated to agree with him, but Monica had shut down. There was no point pushing her any farther.
I'm gonna leave you my card, Bender said. It has my cell on it. You can call me day or night if you remember anything. I'm here to help. I mean that.
They stood up from the couch and Monica Gear shivered. Her hand stayed pressed against her face, shielding him from seeing them. Her voice was soft and weak when she said,
He was a smoker.
Rain and Bender stopped moving.
He threw his cigarette away,
as he walked up to my car.
Harv Bender carried two full bags of trash down the driveway from Monica Gear's house. He'd gathered up all the takeout containers and whatever was stuffed inside her kitchen trash can. She told him he didn't have to. He did it anyway. Rain was waiting for him at the car.
You mind giving me a lift out to where Monica was found? Why, you gonna pick up every cigarette butt you find along the side of the road?
Bender asked, wiping his hands on his pants.
No, just the one where she saw him flick it, Rain said. Jesus Christ, you really are crazy, Bender said. Come on, get in.
Once they were in, Harf started the car and pulled away from the curb.
The chances of us finding that cigarette butt are slim and none. The chances of it having any DNA on it after sitting out in the woods all this time are even less. What's the point?
Maybe he smokes a cigarette before he approaches each woman. If we can find it, we identify the brand, and you can start pulling video from every gas station in the area to look for any white males of average height who purchase those kinds of cigarettes. After that, you see if one of them bought those particular cigarettes on any of the days marked on the calendar.
What calendar?
This calendar, Rain said, pulling a folded sheet of paper out of his pocket. I marked off all the days of the other incidents where women were being followed. Bender unfolded the page as he steered, seeing Rain's handwriting scribbled all over it.
You have any idea how long it's going to take me to look for cigarette butts at all these places in the woods and then go through all that video?
Who are you kidding, Harv? You'll get one of your peons to do it for you.
Yeah, but still, they'll be tied up doing this crap instead of other stuff I need them to do.
He slid the page into his binder, tucking it away for later.
It must be hell for you, huh?
Seeing you as the chief of county detectives while I live in disgrace, Harv? Rain asked.
I try not to think about it, to be honest. That's not what I meant, Bender said. I meant, you know, owning a Ferrari and not being able to drive it.
Rain turned his head. You'll have to walk me through this one. I'm not following. Bender grimaced, struggling to form the concept in his head into the right words.
Okay, see, you're like a person who loves to race. You love nothing better than to get out there on the open road and put the pedal to the metal. It's what you live for. This case, it's like a long, clean stretch of track to you. And you got a Ferrari, right? It's faster than anything else on the road. But instead of being out there racing, leaving everybody in the dust, your Ferrari just sits there. It's like you got locked out of your own race car and can't find the keys to get back in.
Rain stared through the window, watching the cars go past.
Yeah, it's something like that, he said.
Chapter 17. There is family you are born with, and family you choose. At Carrie Santero's age, her mother was already married. She had started a home, delivered a baby, and before that, she had toured the country with various bands. All of her mother's stories were about long nights of banjo music and becoming one with the universe and other fake hippie bullshit. In just one more year, Carrie would be the same age her mother was when she left home and never came back. Whenever Carrie's best friend, Molly, had offered to pierce her in some new body part, normally with nothing more than a safety pin heated by a lighter, she'd think of her mother when the pain hit. Whenever they'd mosh at basement clubs in distant cities, she'd think of her mother when it was time to jump up and kick the biggest asshole on the floor. She and Molly would chug vodka from whatever bottle they'd stolen from the local stores. Sometimes they'd steal it from Penny, Molly's mom, and refill it with water. Molly was a goofy drunk, prone to collapsing in fits of laughter and passing out. Carrie never minded. She'd go outside and sit, looking up at the sky, and picture her mother. She imagined her dancing in some distant field, surrounded by dandelions, barefoot in the mud, surrounded by a drum circle or jam band or whatever lame-ass local musicians she'd attached herself to, and oh, so at one with the fucking universe.
and Carrie would raise both her middle fingers and bare her teeth in rage. It was the same feeling she had the night she graduated the police academy, the same one she felt when she got sworn in as the first female patrol officer in Coyote Township. It was the same internal fuck you that kept her going now. She didn't hate her mother for leaving. She didn't now, and she hadn't then. She was angry, sure, but did not hate the woman. Not for that. Her mother's entire life, from what Carrie knew of it, was spent running towards some imaginary land that did not exist. An illusion of what life was like before modern technology and suburbs and cell phones. A place filled with rainbows, where peace and love reigned, and all the happy little white girls in dreadlocks ran naked through the forest. People like her mother hitchhiked, or picked up hitchhikers. They wound up raped or dead, but at least they hadn't compromised their commitment to peace and love. People like her mother believed in crystals and past lives, and all that you needed was some organic carrot juice and fresh cilantro to cure cancer. They had a fiercely determined, self-centered devotion to illusion. And that was what Carrie hated. Idiots and their illusions. Harv Bender's illusions of power. Steve Auburn's illusions of legacy and small-town bullshit. Mrs. Pugh's illusion that her daughter was on some farm, grown up and waiting to come home. Her own mother's illusions of happiness through music and peace and free love. Carrie knew different. Carrie knew it took strength, overwhelming strength, to look into the endless expanse of chaos that formed the universe, where destruction is constant, and stand up against it. Reality was blood and steel, fire. Reality was bad people doing bad things and good people burying their heads while it happened. No, Carrie told herself. The ones burying their heads weren't the good people at all. Good people have scars. Good people are weary of the fight. Good people know they'll eventually get fed into the threshing machine, but goddammit, they aren't backing down. Most of the good people died a long time ago, leaving the rest of us on our own. We are just the ones who got left behind. Compelled to go on as long and hard as we can, until the abyss takes us too. Carrie stood at the front door and knocked, leaning her forearm against the glass and cupping her hands to see inside. Only shadows could be seen inside the small windows built into the front door. She knocked again and called out, "Hello? You guys home?" A thick, clotted cough came from deep inside the house. Carrie could see the form of a small woman shuffling toward the door. "Hang on!" And then another cough. Carrie stepped back, holding the screen door open as the knob twisted. An older woman appeared from behind the door, her brown, tanning bed and rich skin looking like the underside of a wrinkled brown paper bag. Penny looked 100 years older than the day her daughter, Molly, died. No, Carrie thought. Older than that. An unlit cigarette dangled from Penny's lips, leaving bright red lipstick stains on its white filter.
"I thought you were away."
"I just got back," Carrie said, moving past her into the house.
"How many times do I have to tell you to use your key?"
"How many times do I have to tell you to use the deadbolt and chain?" Penny rolled her eyes, then jerked her head back in surprise as Carrie's hand flicked forward, snatching the cigarette out of her mouth. Carrie held it up between them both. "You promised you'd quit." Penny snatched it back, breaking it at the center. She tucked it back between her lips.
"I did quit. It's not lit, is it?"
Carrie's eyes narrowed.
"That's not going to help you." "I don't do it because I like cigarettes," Penny said, tapping Carrie on the arm and whispering. "I got one of them oral fixations."
Carrie cringed, unable to stop herself from laughing. "You're a dirty old woman, you know that?"
"You'll get there, kid. You hungry?"
"Starving." Penny retreated into the kitchen, saying,
"Well, go on up, then. We both know I'm not who you came for, anyway."
That's not true, Carrie said, peering around the corner. I came to see you too, because I'd figured you'd be cooking.
She flashed a smile and turned, making her way up the stairs, slow and deliberate, using just the ledge of each step to keep it from squeaking. She could hear a little girl singing from inside the first bedroom. The door was shut just enough to let Carrie come up the steps past it and lean along the wall, looking in. Nubs was brushing the long blonde hair of one of her dolls and singing to it. Beside her was a long line of other dolls, ones Carrie had bought over the past year, all of them with neatly, newly brushed hair. The bedroom was filled with toys, stuffed animals, and so many books they had to be stacked alongside the bookshelves that were too full to hold anything else. It was a little girl's room, full of hearts and rainbows, and it made Carrie laugh to think of how differently it looked now. As a young teenager, when she'd first met Molly, the room was covered in posters for punk bands and cut-out pictures from magazines of all the famous people Molly thought were hot. She loved candles and painted skulls and tarot cards and anything else she could find that looked goth. The only normal thing Molly had was a bright blue vase she kept on her desk that was never filled with flowers. It was where she hid her pot. By the time Carrie moved in with Molly and Penny, the room hadn't changed much. The only new additions were a few 45 RPM records they bought at True Vinyl, the store they both worked at after school. They'd pinned the records to the wall to display them, and even now, Carrie could see the faded outlines where they'd hung. The records were long gone. She'd have given almost anything to have them back. Songs she and Molly would listen to for hours and feel so deeply, even when they weren't high. When Molly got pregnant, the two of them had stripped the room down to the bed frame and bare walls. They'd cleaned it on their hands and knees and built Nub's crib together in the center of the empty room. After Molly died, Carrie had stripped the room down once more. She'd done it alone, sending Penny and Nubs out for the day, while she'd cleaned and cried and boxed up every reminder of her beloved friend. She kept some t-shirts for herself. She saved the rest for when Nubs was old enough to wear them. By the time they came back, Carrie presented Nubs with her brand new private personal bedroom. The only reminder was a framed photograph of Molly holding Nubs, hanging in the center of the wall. Penny had stood on the porch hugging Carrie that night for half an hour, sobbing into Carrie's shoulder, and Carrie cried with her. She knocked softly on the door. Nub stopped singing and looked up from her doll, the smile wide and brilliant across her face. "I like your song," Carrie said, coming into the room. She sat down on the floor across from the little girl, picked up one of the dolls and felt its hair. "You did a great job on these. They look beautiful." "Do you want me to brush yours?" Nub asked, holding up her plastic brush. "Of course," Carrie said, then paused. "Hold on," she said, reaching for the sides of Nub's face. "Do I see a new missing tooth in there?" Nubs opened her mouth and pointed to an empty space in her gum. "It came out yesterday." Carrie's eyes widened. "Did you lose it in a fight?" Nub stifled a laugh. "No, it just came out, the same as the others." "Are you sure? I don't think you're supposed to lose that many baby teeth so soon. You must be growing up super fast or something. Here, stand up and let me look at you." Carrie gasped as Nub stood up. "I think you are twice as big as before. You must be going to bed on time and eating all your vegetables. That's the only explanation." "Except Brussels sprouts," Nub said, making a face. "Well, duh," Carrie said, wrapping her arms around Nubs and pulling her in for a long embrace. "Nobody likes them until they turn into an old person. Do you like them?" Carrie sighed and said, "God help me. I'm starting to." By evening, empty plates and bowls were scattered across the table. Penny's thick homemade sauce was smeared across their rims and stained on the napkins stuffed inside the empty drinking glasses. Penny sipped the last of her wine, her left hand outstretched. stroking Carrie's hair the way she'd done it over the years whenever there had been trouble. They didn't talk about it. There was never a need to. Nubs was nestled against Carrie's side, the little girl's head resting on the curve of her breast. She was scratching Nubs' back with her nails, making the child giggle whenever she went too high, up onto the delicate skin of her neck. The TV was on, something Nubs wanted to watch. Carrie's feet were up on the table, resting. It was good. And it was safe. She fell asleep.